of the quantization procedure one can adopt if one wants to quantize the non-relativistic particle using path integral methods. And I kind of listed the steps for you that you adopt in this kind of Feynman-Hipps procedure. And then explain to you that while we want to follow the very same procedure in principle in gravity, but of course that entails a significant complications, as one might imagine, just going from a case of a system with 3 degrees of freedom to one with infinitely many degrees of freedom, a pure theoretical example. However, my interest also in going back to this particle case was to emphasize the geometry of the construction. So the way one usually sets up this discretization procedure is one doesn't consider arbitrary paths. Of course, in the superposition principle tells us to take a quantum superposition of all the amplitudes corresponding to all possible paths, say, to go from some initial to some endpoint in a specific time. But this is a kind of is a difficult space to handle, and that's why we introduced this regularization to say, well, we cut up our time interval to start with n equal pieces, and we consider only special piecewise straight paths, so that just consists of straight segments in each of these time intervals. And the nice thing about this is that it simplifies matters very much, because in order to describe a single path, you only need to have a bunch of numbers just that specify at these discrete time intervals where the path integral where the particle is. And then I said, well, the quite straightforward analog of this, when we want to describe the dynamics of higher dimensional geometry and their intrinsic curvature properties, is to use something that's called a triangulation, or a simplicial representation, if you like, where you consider in an analog of what was a straight, piecewise straight path of a particle, you consider piecewise straight or piecewise flat geometries. So your building blocks are then some higher dimensional generalization of kind of the one-dimensional kind of straight segments of the path, and it's convenient to choose them to be triangles and they're higher dimensional generalizations. And they are called, they go by the name of D-simplices in D dimensions. So in 3 dimensions, we will have tetrahedra, 4 dimensions, we will have 4 simplices, and so on. I should say it's not necessary that you use triangular building blocks. It is just a convenient choice. And why is it convenient? Because actually, as many people realize, say, when they want to dynamically model surfaces, say, animated movies, triangles, in a very efficient way, model curved surfaces better than, say, squares. Right? You can, of course, also perfectly model a curved surface using squares. For example, right? You just, well, of course, I cannot put this isometrically down on the board, but you can glue together 4 squares. With all the right angles, so that they form a piece of curved surface. But, well, here you have 90 degree angles, here you have 60 degree angles, so you see that you can model this at smaller scales, you have more variety of how you distribute kind of curvature, Gaussian type curvature that comes into play. So again, triangles are not an absolute necessity, but they are convenient to model curved spaces, curved space times in an efficient manner. So I emphasize then, of course, the intrinsic nature of the geometry we want to describe, just in the context of Einstein general relativity and the quantization thereof. And of course, then our next task, after introducing these kind of regularized type of geometries was to re-express all the dynamical quantities of the theory in terms of the variables that describe these triangulations. And I told you, well, there's basically there are two aspects. To the description as a triangulation, first you pick the triangulation, by which I mean you have a bunch of triangles, or I mean higher dimensional simplices, and then you, well, you tell me how you glue them together. How could you do that in practice, or how actually, if you say model this on a computer, how do we do this in practice? We attach a label to each building block, and then we make up a big list, a square matrix, where the labels of these building blocks appear one after the other, and whenever two building blocks share a common face, as it said, so that is a surface of dimension d minus 1. If the building block was d-dimensional, then you put a 1 in the matrix, otherwise you put a 0. In that way, you get a connectivity matrix that just keeps exactly track of what is glued to, you know, what other building block. So that's one way of keeping track of what this triangulation is. And then in addition, of course, we had then these length assignments, as I explained yesterday, to the individual edges. And now basically, if you want to take these types of geometries as a starting point for a quantization, more specifically a path integral quantization, there are essentially two ways. So this is what kind of became of our kind of G mu nu modulo gauge. It's just these data. These are the discretized, regularized data. So if you want to quantize based on this, there are two different ways of doing it. Way A goes by the name of dynamical triangulation. And what you do there is you essentially fix these edge lengths, Li squared, to be all the same. Or actually, because you want to allow, already anticipating that you may want to use this in Lorentzian signature, you allow two types of edge lengths, positive length squared and negative length squared, corresponding to space-like and time-like edges. But otherwise, they're equilateral. And you, what you then do, you let T vary. That just means the way, well, the gluing is, you know, between these d-dimensional building blocks. And what you do in the path interval, you sum over T. So two ways of doing the path integral. The path integral based on these quantities. And the other possibility is kind of the converse, and that goes by the name of quantum ratchet calculus. In that case, you fix a triangulation, but you leave the edge length to vary. So you fix T, and what does that look like in the path integral? You get an integration over the possible Li squared. So integrate over Li or Li squared, whatever. That's the same. So let me introduce these two abbreviations for these two possibilities. From the early 80s on, we've actually started working with this in order to kind of formulate the path integral. And this is a development that started about 10-15 years after that. Now, if you want to do classical general relativity using this discretization, which you might find appealing, because first of all, it represents, well, say if you want to numerically solve the Einstein equations, of course you have to make the problem into a finite one, because the computer cannot handle anything else. So this might be a convenient way that at the same time is already kind of explicitly gauge invariant, if you like, to do this in the classical theory. If that is your interest, you definitely should go with this Rajic calculus, because here you see some of your variables are still continuous variables, so a little bit like the G mean, which you can continuously vary. Whereas when you're in such a formulation, that is no longer true. There are no infinitesimal variations, because you can only hop between one triangulation and another gluing of the same building blocks. But this is not a continuous. This is not a continuous process. So this is certainly not a convenient way to do things, to employ such a formalism when you want to do classical calculations. But this is, of course, not what we are after here. We are after a quantum formulation. And there it actually turns out that this first way of doing things has a number of advantages. So I won't write these down, just to give you an idea. So first of all, there is some kind of memory, certainly if you do Rajic calculus or quantum Rajic calculus in the vicinity of a classical highly symmetric solution, that there is some residual gauge degrees of freedom floating around in this formulation, which are no longer here, there in the dynamical triangulation picture. That's one. Secondly, if you write down now the action as a function of these data, I gave you the explicit expressions in general dimension yesterday, so the curvature term and the volume term, it turns out that in quantum Rajic calculus, the action is not finite, even in this regularized setting. So even if your path integral just consists of a bunch of finite integrations over a finite number of edge lengths, it's not a well-defined expression, because the action as a function of these LIs is not bounded. So what you have to do is then you have to fix additional regulators in order, even at this level, to make the path integral well-defined. It is not necessary here. Here, the curvature term turns out to be bounded in terms of the total volume. So whenever your triangulation consists only of a finite number of building blocks, the regularized path integral that comes out of here is just a finite expression. You don't have to do anything else to achieve that. Now, thirdly, so there is a kind of tricky something you don't immediately see, but imagine now, so you do kind of this Rajic calculus, and, well, just for simplicity, just think of it in two dimensions. So you are now allowed to vary the edge length. But, of course, you cannot do this arbitrarily, because what you have to obey, for each triangle in your triangulation, you have to obey triangle inequalities in order for three real numbers to actually describe the edges of a flat triangle. Namely, it can never happen, right, that the sum of two of them is kind of smaller than the third edge length, because then I wouldn't have a geometry defined. In other words, these LIs, they are not unrestricted variables. They are not just arbitrary real-valued variables. And if I write down kind of an integral, dl1, dl2, etc., say if my triangulation has n edge lengths, then it's not true that this is just an integration over R for each of these variables. But there is a whole bunch for each triangle. Obviously, you get an inequality on any subset of three of those. And as a result, for this entire integration, you get highly complicated relations on the boundaries of these integrations. And it's actually something you can no longer handle analytically once it goes just beyond a few triangles. It's just too complicated to deal with. As a result, not even in two dimensions has one really managed to do analytical computations in this framework, say, trying to evaluate toy model path integrals for two-dimensional systems. It's not possible in vector calculus, where it is possible and has been done in this formulation. And you get just analytic expression, which you can compare then with corresponding continuum theories. Okay, and last but not least, but actually quite importantly for us, both of these work modulo these problems I just told you in Euclidean signature. For the quantum version, we don't yet know how to do it for the quantum algebraic calculus. Whereas we do know how to do it here, to incorporate Lorentzian signature and still arrive at a well-defined path integral, which we can wick-rotate to a form which we can then deal with computationally. Okay, so these are a few reasons for me to, for the remainder of these lectures, which is just today and tomorrow, to stick with A and explain you more things that have been done there. So what form does our path integral take? So path integral in terms of these dynamical triangulations. So everyone who was at my colloquium yesterday has seen this expression for the path integral. So it's just the z I use, and it's a limit. This just means, removal of the regulator. A is the edge length that appeared here, and n is just the total number of building blocks. So it's just the size, the discrete volume of my chunk of space over which I'm taking the path integral. Then the sum here is over an equivalent t. And that simply, by inequivalent mean, I mean just distinct gluings. So you have, your n building blocks, and here, your task is to figure out what are all just the distinct ways of gluing them together. So n refers, this is a set of all triangulations of size n, 1 divided, of size n or smaller, I should say, divided by this rate factor, e to the I is ratio of the triangulation T. So A is just my ultraviolet regulator, the edge length. So it plays the wall over UV and cutoff. Now, there is a weight factor, apart from the amplitude, that goes with each of these triangulations, T, and that is the order of the automorphism group. Of the triangulation T. What do I mean by this? It can happen that a given triangulation has some non-trivial symmetries that map the thing onto itself. And all these elements, they make up the automorphism group of a triangulation. And whenever that is the case, you divide out biases. So if you have kind of an especially symmetric triangulation, you could imagine something like, say, you have a, just name some example, you have a just a completely regular, in two dimensions, say, a completely regular triangulation that looks like this, of, say, a cylinder in terms of triangles. And you see there are maps of this object onto itself, say, by just rotating it by, you know, some angle, so this gets mapped onto this, etc. In this case, you would have a non-trivial automorphism group, which has more than one element. Of course, it always has a unit element, but then this is just a trivial factor one. So here, what you're saying here, if you have a geometry with special extra symmetries, then they weigh less in the path integral. And this actually reflects a property that is also present in the continuum. If, well, one can make sense of this construction, because the Wheeler-DeWitt measure, which is a natural measure in the continuum, is also constructed such that if your metric has special isometries, its weight in the path integral is exactly less. In practice, you see, if you go to large triangulation, so n is large, on average, a geometry has no such symmetries at all. It's just a very large, you know, discrete gluing. So in practice, this beyond very small volumes, this is one, essentially. That's the question.
For example, you've done a numerical simulation of all these things.
Yeah.
How would you calculate the automorphism of the size of the group?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. There is a way, a clever way of taking this automatically into account, which has to do with the fact that actually when you put the things in the computer, we have to label them. And then, of course, we have to get rid of this overcounting. But the way we get rid of that happens exactly in the way that it will produce, if there was such a factor, it will produce this thing here. But really, I mean, truly, it's not an issue. Kind of, even if you fudge this, you know, if you were kind of careless and put this to one, none of the results would change, because they're very, very rare in special symmetries. And of course, that reflects, again, the property of the space of all geometries. If you think of that as a classical habitat of Einstein gravity, they're, of course, of measure zero in the space of all geometries. And so a similar, this just reflects something you would expect here. Okay, so what is the curly Tn? So now, well, I'm doing this in the Lorentzian, as indicated by the presence of this factor I there. So these actually, I have to specify later what this means, but the triangulation should be causal triangulations, so the building blocks should be Minkowskian building blocks. With n of your d symplices. And maybe one more word about how we usually think of this limit. So what you call a continuum limit. So you make what you usually keep fixed when you take such a limit is a physical volume. So the picture is, you know, you have a physical system of a certain size, which is in terms of physical units, and you just subdivide it and make the subdivision finer and finer. Yeah. So what you do here when performing this limit, you keep as a four volume, so the physical volume V4, and this just defined to be A to the 4 times N fixed. So that's usually how, this is how we interpret this do it. So this expression has a bunch of nice properties, some of which I have already alluded to. So first of all, it is so defined directly on a regularized version. Let me call it like this, curly G reg, of the space of geometries. So there is no redundancy of coordinate transformations because there are no coordinates here. And as I already said, actually it's manifestly finite, as long as n itself is finite. So you can, well, actually now start trying to understand what its properties are. And you can start trying to understand its properties in this limit. So, of course, the philosophy is this is a regularized model, and you want to get rid of the dependence on these artificial parameters you've just, you know, pulled out of a hat. I mean, this is just something you put by hand, the regularization. And of course, you want to take a limit in which the system loses memory of the artificial structures you use to regularize it. Right. So you have to perform such a limit, as a matter of fact. So if I said before, well, you're free, you know, to regularize in terms of triangles, squares, you know, pentagons, what have you. This is all possible, but of course, with the understanding that you take such a limit, in which all of these turn out to be completely irrelevant features of the arbitrary regularization you picked. If, on the contrary, you would now say, ah, actually, you know, I believe that my universe is made up of little triangles. That's, of course, a completely different story. Then you would not perform this limit. You would maybe think that this A is a fundamental, you know, variable like the Planck length. But then, obviously, in that short distance range, it would make a possibly even big difference whether you work with triangles or squares. So then your dynamical quadrangulation would very likely give different results for physics at the Planck scale. And then, of course, you might say, well, we don't know, because there are so many ways I could choose these shapes, and glue them together. And all of them will, in general, give rise to different quantum theories with different Planck physics. So this is not the philosophy one should follow here. Rather, this is really thought of as, in the standard way of quantum field theory, I impose a regulator with the understanding that I will remove it in the end. So all I'm interested in is, of course, asymptotic behavior, kind of the leading terms that survive in this limit. And only those will kind of capture continuum physics in a way that has a chance of being independent of the regulator. Of course, it is something you need to check in principle, that things don't depend on arbitrary structures you've introduced in order to make your system computable, that these don't survive in some perhaps indirect way all the way down in the continuum theory. Okay. Now, in order to get, well, actually in lower, so you might say, well, how can I be sure that this leads at all to something sensible? And the answer to this is, again, that in lower dimensions, one can compare, say, in two dimensions, this construction, which looks very simple-minded, actually, so, you know, at least conceptually, one can compare the outcome of such a construction, so the results it gives for things like a propagator, with what you can get out of a continuum theory. So in 2D, these systems are sufficiently simple. So doing a path integral over all two-dimensional geometries, Euclidean or Lorentzian, is just about within computational reach in a kind of sort of exact manner. And it reproduces exactly what one gets out of such a model. So that gives us certainly confidence that one isn't making any major blunders in setting this up. Anyway, it's kind of pretty simple-minded. What happens in higher dimensions, of course, a priori you don't know, but you'll just try, well, you just try and find out what this formulation tells you, and you just see whether there's anything interesting, potentially interesting there. Historically, that's of course using a big word, as I said, this is, in the quantum theory, this is, has exclusively been used in the Euclidean context. What means Euclidean context? It means I substitute, well, I have a problem which is taking a path integral over all Lorentzian spacetimes, and I substitute this by another problem which I hope in the end will still give me a resolution to the first problem, and you substitute it by the problem of summing over all Euclidean spacetimes. What is a Euclidean spacetime? Euclidean spacetime is a Euclidean space. There is no time. There is no notion of causality. And classically, you're talking about Riemannian four-dimensional matrix, so metric tensors with signature plus, 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 plus. This is not a small difference, because, of course, all physics relating to causality, having an evolution in a time parameter or with respect to a family of possible time parameters, they only exist, strictly speaking, in the Lorentzian framework. If you're in the Euclidean, you don't know. I mean, a Euclidean time is as good as a Euclidean space direction, so it's all the same. You know, you can walk and back in a Euclidean space direction and in a Euclidean time direction, but of course you cannot do that in a Lorentzian space. The reason why this is not such a big issue if you just consider quantum field theories on a flat background is that in these cases we have a very simple map that maps us from kind of Minkowski space, four-dimensional Minkowski space, to to a four-dimensional flat Euclidean space, and that is the basis of what leads to what is called weak rotation in the usual context of perturbative field theories, where you have just theorems that tell you I can compute, say, the endpoint functions of my theory in the Euclidean regime, and then I'm assured that I can rotate them back to the Lorentzian regime in an essentially unique way, and nothing bad happens on the way. For gravity, of course, we're not just talking about Flat-Minkowski space. On the contrary, I mean, Flat-Minkowski space, you know, is just one little dot in the huge ocean of curved spacetimes. We don't have nice in the continuum. We don't know of any nice maps that map, you know, a given Lorentzian spacetime to a Euclidean one, because they're physically quite different objects. It's not surprising that it doesn't exist, but it's a stumbling block if you want to do a path integral and you want to start with an expression like this and then say, and then realize that you cannot handle the complex amplitudes and say, let me weak rotate this and let's do all the computations in the Euclidean domain. This is usually barred because you have no idea of how to do this rotation. So then people make a kind of a jump and say, okay, I don't know how to do the rotation, but let me substitute this problem by the problem of doing everything in the Euclidean regime. So what would this amount to here? I would then say, okay, let me just consider, now let's think of this specific context I'm presenting here. Let's consider kind of a Euclidean version of this. You know, I abandon the hope to be able to do this in the Lorentzian framework. Here, I just stick in regularized versions of Euclidean four-dimensional curved spaces. The causal goes away here. This remains. This will be kind of the Euclidean action of the Euclidean triangulations. So let me call them. These are, of course, different objects then. And I work with the minors, with the Euclidean action for those things, and then I have a real quantity. So that's what people do and have done for quite some time, starting back in the 70s, when people seriously looked at these path integrals with the intention of trying to understand what quantum cosmology tells us. So simplified versions, if you like, of the full gravitational path integral. So what one then gets is Euclidean quantum gravity a la Hartle, Hawking. You know, so if these keywords mean anything to you, these are the people that really initiated a big program in Euclidean quantum cosmology. That means trying to evaluate this kind of path integral in the continuum, but for reduced symmetry reduced matrix as they appear in cosmology. Of course, that raises a big question, what is the role of matrix signature in such a path integral construction? In a non-perturbative path integral. You know, is that, again, kind of, are these two things more or less interchangeable? I have already told you this is entirely unobvious because you don't have a Rick rotation. Of course, you see, the hope that people had in following this purely Euclidean quantization program was to say, let us address this problem and let us solve it and let us then look at the solution and then probably, hopefully, the solution will tell us how to rotate it back to the Lorentzian signature. And if that gives you something you can, you're happy with as a valid quantum cosmology theory or quantum gravity theory, everything's hunky-dory. Now, unfortunately, this Euclidean quantization program just got stuck, certainly in this cosmological sector. So nothing much really came of this program. And then, of course, you might go back and ask, can we possibly do better? And that's actually a question that people, including myself, ask themselves when being faced with this type of regularization of full quantum gravity. Because as I'll explain in a minute, this is what people did initially in this dynamical triangulations framework. It works beautifully in two dimensions, but when you come to higher dimensions, certain degeneracies appear, which initially people weren't aware of, but then kind of transpired as time went on. So somehow this seems to also lead to a dead-end road, and it was not really well understood of why this happened. Now, before I continue this story, let me just ask, what would be the expectation of a quantum theory of gravity, either in this or another framework? It would be certainly a necessary condition any formulation should satisfy, is that it should have the correct classical limit coming out. So that is, you set up your quantum theory, it enables you to hopefully study certain observables. Then if you go to sufficiently long distance scales, it must be the case that in some regions you meet again with what is already described to you by the classical theory. So of course there is a whole large range of length scales where the classical theory is known to be valid and describe physics extremely well. So whatever quantum theory you propose, it must reproduce that in an appropriate limit. So that's a kind of actually a watertight condition that must be satisfied by any quantum theory. So that's number one. Number two is that you expect, of course, on very short or Planckian distance scales, that there will be significant deviations from classical behavior, induced by the fact that everything is described by quantum theory, by probability amplitudes, right? So that's kind of what you know everyone has in front of their mental eyes. They think of you know space-time on very short distance scales, like kind of dissolving into some kind of space-time foam. I mean, it's kind of pictures that people have been drawing for a long time. You call that quantum foam, something that doesn't resemble a smooth space-time. In what way precisely? Well, we don't quite know. We're just waving our hands. So, but that's the picture. So that's what one expects to happen at short scale somehow, where, of course, a specific model of quantum gravity will need to make this quantitative, you know, whatever happens there, and make quantitative predictions from it. On large scales, you want to re-derive the classical theory. Now, it turns out, so what turns out to be the problem, say, if you attempt one of these, if you attempt to solve these dynamically triangulated models in the Euclidean framework in dimension larger than 2, is that you get problems with the good classical limit coming out correctly. So it's not that you don't find, yeah, perhaps funny things going on at short scale. That's not the issue so much. There are lots of funny things going on in these models. But what seems to be absent from them in dimension 3 or higher is a nice limit that has even remotely anything to do with a four-dimensional smooth manifold. Now, how was that discovered? Of course, well, just staring at an expression like this won't tell you anything. But as I already told you, actually in higher dimensions, we are unable to understand what the physics behind such a non-perturbative sum is. So the only initial kind of quantitative evaluation one has of this goes via computer simulations, which approximate with the help of which you can approximately evaluate these state sums as functions of the bare parameters you put into the theory initially, the bare coupling parameters. And what one found, so in this Euclidean regime, by studying certain observables, is that there seems to be very little hope that there is a good classical limit behind them. So, and I want to just give you one example of such an observable to get a flavor you know, of what one can look for, but also to really emphasize the fact how, in a very crucial manner, you do use these computer simulations. So, there is a great hesitancy among theoreticians to say, well, to accept kind of numerical methods as valid methods, because something is there in our indication that makes us believe we should be able you know, to write down, say, the solution of quantum gravity or of string theory or what have you, in closed form, analytic form, on the back of a stamp, essentially, if we are only clever enough. Now, as it turns out, of course, there are problems that are essentially non-perturbative in nature, where the usual ways of our doing analytic computations don't get you very far. And you just have to resort to other methods in order to understand at least partially what your dynamical system is about. And of course, that is absolutely no news if you talk about you know, complex systems, even you know, systems that come, kind of solid state systems. You essentially rely on such methods. But it's also true for something like QCD. Yeah? If you are interested kind of in long distance behavior of QCD, then currently the only way we know how to extract information, quantitative information about this non-perturbative sector, is via lattice QCD. And what these people can do is rather amazing. You know how one just can compute masses of certain excitations and. Well, of course, in QCD, the situation is slightly different in the sense that we know in principle what we want to calculate. We know very much about the theory, and we're only lacking kind of the analytic tools to do certain computations. And then, well, of course, the better our computers get, the better you're actually able to provide this kind of information using simulations. Now here we are in a, well, our task is much harder because it's not that we have already the quantum theory of gravity given, and we now just, we make our computers, you know, do the calculation and we can already anticipate what comes out. No, it's not like this. We are on completely uncharted territory with respect to what the result is going to be. So what I want to emphasize is in that situation, and in a situation where we strongly believe, well, you have to be non-perturbative. So far away, so perturbation theory, of course, close to a classical solution is explicitly not known to not work in these circumstances. Then you have to rely to some extent on these, on such numerical methods. And you would be stupid if you ignored them, because they will, at this stage, they give you non-trivial information about the theory, which you don't know how to get in any other way. And of course, a vision one would have is that they help you, well, as you'll see, I'll give you an example. Numerical simulations help you to tell you what the model is doing. Are you on the right track, or is it out of the question that this can ever be lead to a good quantum theory? And they are very well able to tell you that, with a measuring accuracy, of course. And they may then lead you towards the right track, and this is very important in a theory such as quantum gravity, where we have zero experiments or observations to guide us. So there is a very clear danger, which I emphasized right at the beginning of all these lectures, to say, well, you know, we must be careful not to go out on some tangent and, you know, dream up whatever fancy things could happen at the Planck scale, which we'll never be able to relate kind of to macroscopic physics in the end. So it's a kind of reality a check for us. So here I'll give you an observable. See what I mean by this? Which can be used to characterize what I want to call quantum geometry. What I mean by quantum geometry is something like a ground state that emerges from a construction like this and its geometric properties. So something that emerges, kind of the quantum geometry that is given to you by the superposition of all the contributions from all the paths in your path integral. So, I mean, the logic is really quite simple-minded, like in the standard path integral. So what is this? It's a so-called Hausdorff dimension. So what is the Hausdorff dimension, physically speaking? So imagine you're somewhere on a space where you at least have access to length and volume measurements. So certainly, each one of these regularized triangulations would qualify. Any smooth metric manifold will also qualify. And even more general objects than triangulations will also qualify, as long as you have some kind of distance measure around. So what you do is you look at the volume. So you pick a point in your space. So I'm here now presupposing that I have a Euclidean, a kind of a positive, my distances are positive. There are also Lorentzian versions of this, but let's not complicate matters. So I pick a point in my space and I draw what is called a geodesic ball of a certain radius. And I measure its volume. I do that for many different radii. So many different sizes of these geodesic balls. So what's a geodesic ball? Right, it's just some set of all points which have geodesic distance. R. And then I consider the volume that the thing has. And then I simply, so I do that for many R, and then I look at the leading power law behavior this volume has as a function of R, of the radius, of the linear size of this BPC4. So you can actually see it's very easily implemented in this context of dynamical triangulations, because again in two dimensions you just pick a point and what is you do is you walk out in concentric kind of circles of radius 1. So you have your radius comes in discrete units. So this would be the geodesic ball of radius 1. And okay, let me extend this here a little bit. This would be the geodesic radius of distance 2, etc. And then you simply count the number of building blocks inside to obtain kind of the discrete version of this volume. And then you just see how this scales. So it's clear how it works for a single triangulated manifold. Of course, what we are interested in, we are interested in measuring this quantity in the ensemble of geometries, because of course we don't just pick out a single geometry from the path integral. That is by itself not physical, but we have to take averages in order to obtain the expectation value of this guy. And the way you do it is, you randomize or you integrate over all your geometries, and you integrate over all points here, which you use as a starting point for this construction. So you have a twofold average. Yes.
Is the Hausdorff dimension related at all to the dimensionality of your simplices? Like, is there?
No, not a priori. No. As we'll see in a second, and that's exactly the point. Of course, you see when you're very close to the cutoff, then you still see, you see really the dimension of the simplicity. So very close to the cutoff, the answer to the question is yes. But as soon as you come to distances that are where the cutoff is just appreciably just small compared to the length scale you consider, it no longer plays a role.
Is it then a function of the curvature of your
It's a function of the geometric setup. So, and I give an example exactly right now. So, you can implement this in a straightforward way in this dynamical triangulations business. So in this framework, the geodesic distance R has a natural implementation as the number of edges in the shortest path between two given points, vertices in that case between. So that, of course, is just a straightforward implementation of what you do in a Riemannian spacetime. So, and the V of R, of course, as I already said, is then the number of d-dimensional symplices inside this geodesic radius R. And the picture is already there. So the interesting thing now is, okay, what happens in the path integral? So really what you do in the path integral, you then look at the expectation value of this quantity. So where, as I explained, you take both the ensemble average over all geometries and you average over all initial points of your construction. So let me just quote what the result is for you. So result, for this, I know I emphasize now that this Euclidean, so the original approach, the Euclidean dynamical triangulations from four-dimensional symplices actually turns out that it depends on the value of one of your coupling constants. So in the Euclidean regime, actually you have two coupling constants. One is Newton's constant, or rather what one works with is kind of the inverse Newton constant. And the other one is the bare cosmological constant lambda. So depending on where you are in this phase diagram, different things happen. So first of all, one information I have to provide to you is that potentially interesting continuum physics exists along a one-dimensional line in this phase space. And it's another way of rephrasing that one has to fine-tune one of the bare coupling constants, in this case the lambda, to get to this line. It's a critical line using the language of phase transitions, using the language of critical systems. So how we get there shouldn't be of any relevance to you. So you only need to know there is this line, and along this line I study the system. And I want to understand how it depends on kappa naught, and I want to understand what its Hausdorff dimension is. So there's actually kind of a transition point somewhere here in between, and what one finds is two different types of behavior depending on whether one is to the left or to the right of this point. So this is my kappa naught critical. So as it turns out, the geometry associated with this branch and that branch is totally different. And this is a so-called, here, what belongs here is the so-called crumpled phase. And what happens on this right branch here is the branched polymer phase. Now, what are the Hausdorff dimensions in those two phases? In the crumpled phase, the Hausdorff dimension is infinite within measuring accuracy. In the branched polymer phase, it is 2. So that's a nice surprise, right? You put in four-dimensional building blocks, you perform this construction, and the Hausdorff dimension of this thing you're getting in the limit is not 4. Now, you ask yourself, well, how could that happen? How could it possibly happen? Well, of course, part of the reason is that you're taking a non-trivial limit where kind of this discreteness scale kind of shrinks to zero. Now, what do typical geometries look like in these two phases? Now, what happens in the branched polymer phase is the following thing, is that, of course, locally, if I look at, you know, as I was just explaining tonight, if I just look very at the level of the cutoff scale, well, everything looks perfectly four-dimensional. But that's not what I'm doing when I take this limit. Then I take a step back, and these become finer and finer and finer. And what happens in the branched polymer phase is that a typical geometry looks like this. It's like a one-dimensional thing which branches everywhere. Thus, the name branched polymer. So it's if you look locally, it's a one-dimensional, essentially one-dimensional object which branches, or even branches very much. So how can that come about? You might say, well, of course, if I zoom in to one of these typical histories, and I look locally, I blow this up, I see that what they are made of are these four-dimensional building blocks. But these four-dimensional building blocks arrange themselves in a way that, well, most of the dimensions are rolled, curled up, right? So that is a very familiar story to string theorists, obviously. And they don't contribute to the linear extension of the entire system. So there is actually a kind of an entropic effect that makes the result of the path integral come out such that the type of geometry that completely overwhelms, completely dominates in this phase is of this nature. So with probability one, you just pick a random, you know, path integral history out of your ensemble, it will look like this. And clearly, well, this is Hausdorff dimension two, and of course you can stare at a while, for a while at this thing, and you're trying to rack your brain of maybe how you could relate it to four-dimensional geometry after all. But there is just no way. I mean, there is an effective description of this phase, given kind of an effective action, which is just a branched polymer system. So it has nothing whatsoever to do, on large scale certainly, with what you would expect from a quantum gravity theory with a good classical limit. Yeah.
What do you expect at the critical point? Is there some scaling variance?
Yeah, that is still a possibility, because I'm going to explain. This is also no good, clearly. There was some hope that something interesting might happen around this transition, but this just turned out to be a first-order transition. So you don't have any non-trivial scaling properties associated with this point. Just very quickly, the crumpled phase is kind of a converse, where what the typical geometry looks like this. Every building block shares one or perhaps two vertices. So you see, even if you stuff more and more and more volume into such a system, it will only generate, well, more four simplicities that share the single point. And as a result, of course, this always stays. It never grows beyond the cutoff length, essentially. So that is the so-called crumpled phase. And you can already imagine that, of course, this is absolutely no good large-scale interpretation in terms of the classical geometry, because it never grows. You know, it always stays tiny. Never mind how much volume you pump into this. So there are two things to emphasize. So here, we looked at an observable, and this observable, well, gives us clearly a first hint of something that is the quantum dynamics of the system, depending on where you sit with respect to these coupling constants. And you don't find any region, I'm cutting a long story short, it was not that this was immediately realized by people that this was going on. But you've used your simulations to make these measurements, which then forced you to think, now, hey, what is the origin of this? Then you uncovered this behavior, and you figured out what are effective action that would describe these behaviors, and unfortunately they have nothing on large scales, nothing whatever to do with classical gravity. That means this was a good attempt, it was a candidate theory of quantum gravity, but unfortunately it doesn't seem to be the correct one. So, and the without the computer simulations, I bet people would still be staring at this partition function without realizing that they are describing structures that are completely uninteresting from the point of view of physics one wants to describe. So this is just to give you a little hint of how these methods come in, to give you highly non-trivial information about the system. Okay, and how to do things better, we'll explain tomorrow in our last remaining hour. Thanks.
I have a question.
Yeah.
If you put higher dimensional synthesis,